The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Welcome, everybody. We're at a symposium on Michael Roberts' book, The Long Depression, which came out in 2016, I believe, published by Haymarket Press. So we have Fred Mosley here, all the way on the left, from a professor at Mount Holyoke College, and Pete Green from the UK, both of whom are going to respond for about 20 minutes apiece to Michael's book, give a sort of précis, and then their kind of critiques. Michael's going to have about 20 minutes to respond, and then we should have a full half hour for discussion. If you haven't read the book, that's okay. If you have read the book, it's even better.
Can I just ask if everybody was at the session last night with Anwar Sheikh? Not everybody.
Or the session yesterday afternoon.
One way or the other. They were there, yes.
And how many have actually read this book or have got a copy? Hands up. Anybody who puts their hand, doesn't keep their hand up.
Well, you said or has a copy.
Yeah, all right. That's even worse.
Okay, so I'm going to turn it over. Pete, are you going first or Fred? Fred?
Okay,
so take it away, Fred. And I'll let you know, for everybody, I'll let you know when you're 15 minutes past. I'll give you a 5-minute
warning. Okay, I probably won't take all of that. Since we've got such a distinguished group here, we can have more of a discussion. But, I mean, I think this is a really excellent book. I would say the best book on the current crisis. What Bob calls the Long Depression. And its most distinctive feature is the emphasis on the rate of profit. That's the key variable overall in the dynamics of capitalism and specifically in the analysis of recent decades, the post-war period and the current crisis. That's striking in particular compared to mainstream economists and mainstream analyses of the current crisis, which never mention the rate of profit. It's incredible. Does anybody know any mainstream economists where the rate of profit is a key variable? I mean, in mainstream macro, either Keynesian or classical, the rate of profit is not even a variable. I was shocked when I first realized that in graduate school. Right? This is a theory of capitalism, right? Without the rate of profit,
profit doesn't exist in equilibrium.
It disappears.
And that too. That stuck me for a while too. In long run equilibrium, profits are zero. You know? And it's not just that this is a general theoretical point that profit is the main goal and the most important feature of capitalism, but the rate of profit, by all accounts, declined very significantly in the post-war period, right? I mean, if it had been more or less level, we could dismiss it, maybe, right? But a very significant downward trend, some disagreement maybe about how much it's recovered since the early 80s, but, a 50% decline, by all accounts, in the rate of profit from the 50s to the early 80s, right? So, I mean, 50% decline in the rate of profit has to have an effect, has to be important, has to be an important part of what's going on here, right? And to completely ignore that, I don't know what a good analogy is, but it's certainly a bankruptcy in our analogy. But it's not, it's not solely based on the rate of profit. There's also a chapter on debt matters, right? And an analysis how, after the 50% decline in the rate of profit, capitalists attempted by all means possible to restore the rate of profit, right? And that consisted mainly of wage suppression, satisfy a variety of needs. So Bob's argument is that, and I more or less agree with this, have presented a similar argument, that kind of led into the wage suppression resulted in insufficient purchasing power, demand especially for big ticket items like houses and cars and so forth. And so that kind of potential demand problem was overcome, at least in the short run, by an explosion of household debt. You all know the story. And this is where the mainstream economists kind of pick it up, right? Mm. But as if the wage suppression and the debt explosion dropped out of the sky, right? And somehow, capitalists got greedy all of a sudden, but don't recognize that this was a response to a real problem. Right? It wasn't a permanent solution, but it was a rational response to the decline of rate of profit. So then the debt explosion led to the debt crisis, the financial crisis, and so forth. So, that's part of the story also, right? And I think that's basically the story of the current crisis, right? That goes back to the deep roots of the 50% decline in the rate of profit, and then the period of attempts to restore, and the contradictions that led to. I think that's the best analysis there is of the current crisis. It doesn't answer all the questions, but I think that's the core of the crisis dynamics. So I don't have anything too much critical to say about that, although maybe a couple of points later on. But I want to move next to the empirical work. And that's actually one of Bob's real strengths. He's kind of the top authority these days in estimates of the rate of profit. And I did some of this empirical work when I was a young man years ago. I haven't dared go back to that. But I do have some knowledge and some questions and maybe suggestions about ways. I mean, and I don't think any of these really make that much of a difference in the overall trend, the basic dynamics. But I would like to know that for sure, right? And so I would like some kind of refinement and fine-tuning of the estimates to really have the most rigorous set of estimates possible, I guess, of this crucial variable in Marx's theory and in the capitalist economy. So I think my main question is with respect to government wages. Bob has a short appendix explaining his estimation methods, but it's not entirely clear to me, are government wages included in variable capital, right, or not? Is it just the wages of the private sector, right? I argue that government wages should not be included, right? That government wages is not capital, right? It's not variable capital, right? It's government spending, and that could be a kind of proxy for an after-tax rate of profit, including the government spending, but that's not even the best proxy for that. You could just subtract taxes if you wanted an after-tax rate of profit. So, and variable capital is subtracted from the net national product in order to arrive at the estimates of profit, right? So what you put in variable capital is going to affect the residual, what's left for profit. If in fact government wages are included in variable capital, then I think in the current estimates, then I think there should at least be an alternative set of estimates.
Yes.
Right? And where we can compare and contrast and see what difference it makes, and not just the kind of assert or assume that it doesn't make any difference. Another question which comes up often in these estimates is, what about foreign profits? Right? Are they included in the national income accounts estimates of profits? And I know there have been some recent changes, perhaps, that since my time, and so I'm not sure what the current methodology is. But you know, given globalization and outsourcing and increasing foreign investment in U.S. corporations, how profits on those foreign operations and foreign investments are included or not would probably make a difference, and not only in the absolute levels, but in the trend. You know, if there have been an increasing proportion of foreign profits, that's going to affect the trend and would overestimate the downward trend, right? If that is indeed not included. Then I have a question about more kind of arcane question, but it could be important. You know, so profit is net national product minus wages minus variable capital. But what exactly is in the net national product? Is another issue. And especially how the so-called imputations, I don't know if you're familiar with this, are included or not. You know, the goal of the national income accounts is not to estimate money variables. I mean, the ultimate goal, because the Keynesian theory is a theory of real variables, and the goal of the national income accounts is aligned with that theory, and so they're really trying to estimate real output, right? That's the product, and so even if output is you know, not produced, not actually produced and sold by capitalist enterprises, if there is output in some way, they want to include that. As a general methodological principle. The biggest one is the imputation for owner-occupied homes.
Yeah.
Right? And it's called imputed housing services, as if owner-occupied homes are rented out to themselves. Right? And so there's an extra added monetary value to try to capture this real output that's not capitalist output. You know, when I did this back in the 70s, that made quite a difference, both in the level and the trends, less so the trends. But you know, I haven't really kept up. I know there have been various methodological revisions over the years. That's one of the reasons why I stopped this business, because you know, every 5 years there would be a new methodology and you'd have to do the whole thing over again. You know, and there's also there's an imputed interest.
Yeah.
I forget exactly how that works.
But it's deductive. It's a phantom imputed interest.
Right, yeah. But it's included in the...
In the NEPA figures,
Okay, so that's just... general questions about these so-called imputations, because the purpose of the estimates are different. Then I have a question about the capital stock, the denominator in the rate of profit.
Yeah.
This question actually came up in a previous session, Historical Materialism in London, back in November, which is, you know, one of the ways that the rate of profit is restored, in theory, is the devaluation of capital, right? Through bankruptcies, write-offs, those sort of devaluation of the existing capital stock, right? And that is, you know, as destructive as it is at the time, is also reconstructive and a way that the rate of profit is restored. And I checked on this a little bit, and I couldn't find any reference at all to any kind of taking into account the devaluation of capital in the official estimates, right? And so that there's at least been some devaluation of capital in the last 20 years, 30 years. And so if that devaluation is not included, then that overestimates the rate, the capital stock in the denominator, and underestimates the rate of profit, and that could affect the trend in recent decades. And so, I mean, I don't know how you would deal with that. They don't want to deal with it because, again, you know, that's a monetary measure. They're trying to measure physical stuff. But my real question is, how much of that has there been? How much devaluation of capital has there been in recent decades? And, you know, that's a private matter for corporations, and it's generally not public information. So I don't know how to deal with that. But it does seem like if you're talking about the trend in the rate of profit, at least some discussion and some attempt maybe should be made to take into account. Okay, then a bit more on the theory. How am I doing?
You got 6 minutes.
With respect to the causes of the decline of the rate of profit, the theoretical question, and Bob presents the kind of classic, and that's what the estimates show, that the rate of profit declined in general because the composition of capital increased faster than the rate of surplus value, right? But the main question I have about the theory, we've talked about this a little bit, is Marx's distinction between productive labor and unproductive labor.
Yeah.
Right. Would, in my early work, in the period of decline, the early post-war period, you know, I tried to make this distinction, including in the estimates, and where profit, the numerator in the convention rate of profit, is the total surplus value minus the unproductive wages and yeah. circulating capital, right? Basically, minus unproductive capital, let's just say, right? So, you know, that doesn't really affect the estimates of the conventional rate of profit, but it does, it could be a cause. Hmm. of the decline in the rate of profit, right? So, you know, the, oops, I guess you let
me know. I put that up in advance, yes.
Okay.
We have to lift this up.
No, but you know, you can't decompose the conventional rate of profit in a way that includes a ratio of unproductive capital to variable capital, right? And my estimates show that that was one of the important causes of the decline in the rate of profit, and according to my old estimates, accounted for almost as much of the decline in the rate of profit as the rise in the composition of capital.
Yeah.
And this is unproductive labor in capitalist enterprises. We're not talking about the government here. We're talking about circulation, finance, supervision, right? The kind of classic unproductive labor employed by capital, right? Now, I know this is a horribly difficult thing to do. So I you know, because I had many blood, sweat, and tears.
You did a good job, though.
But still, when we're that seems to me to be important.
Yeah.
Right. Because when we're talking about, you know, what's necessary to restore the rate of profit, right? A kind of an analysis that ignores productive, unproductive labor. It looks like all we have to do is either raise the rate of surplus value or lower the composition of capital. But if there is this other significant variable out there of the relative rise of unproductive labor, then that suggests, you know, something has to be done about that too, or at least that's another avenue of the restoration of the rate of profit.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, that would be, again, a hell of a job to do, although I think maybe a possibility is the best recent estimates of this distinction in the wages of unproductive labor is Simon Mogul.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, that may, you know, maybe use his estimates, therefore the United States, maybe use his estimates to try to incorporate in your estimates in some way, and at least, you know, see what the trends are, and try to get some idea of how significant that still is or not. Right. So that, I guess that's my main theoretical point. And I would also want to ask, thinking of Simon, you know, Simon argues that. You know, if you just do the normal estimates like I did of the wages of unproductive labor, that includes the $1 million compensation of the top executives.
Yeah.
Right? In finance. Well, I mean, in supervision, basically across the board, right? And so Simon argues that, and in, you know, in my estimates, in the usual estimates, that's part of wages.
Yeah.
Right? And so Simon argues, I think with some justification, that really should be part of profit,
mm-hmm.
right? It's called wages, it's called compensation, but in terms of a class analysis, Simon emphasizes that's really capitalist income and should be. So at least maybe, you know, again, use Simon's estimates. He uses it to analyze the distribution of income,
yeah,
right, and not the rate of profit. Right, but you could use his estimates to, you know, at least have an alternative. Again, I guess that's in general what I'm suggesting.
Yeah.
Kind of maybe a set, you know, of alternative estimates that would allow us to assess the significance of these other factors.
You're about in time, so.
Okay, my last question is, so what's your future predictions?
That's a good one.
There's the subtitle is "What Happens Next," right? There's a kind of not too long final chapter on this. I would like that to be expanded, you know, and some theory and speculation about what will happen to each of these variables. You know, the composition of capital, the rate of surplus value, maybe unproductive labor. Going forward, and what is the likelihood of a restoration, and finally, and most practically and immediately, what are the chances for a recession in 2017? Thank you.
Phew.
Challenge number one.
I knew you'd pose all those questions, but save me doing it. Shall I go?
Please.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I'm gonna be a bit more critical, and that's why Bob, or Michael as he's known, but his real name's Bob, has invited me, which is in itself a mark of you know, interest in having a serious debate, and that's what we want. I really want to recommend that people sign up to Michael's blog, the next recession, or the posts that you put out. And I've been following these for getting on since 2008, I think. And I know they go back further than that, don't they? But
I can't remember. No,
they go back a long way.
2010, I think.
No, they go back further.
Do they?
No,
right,
or
okay.
Something goes back. Anyway,
yeah.
Anyway, they go back a long way. And Michael has a very good record, I think, on you know. In his earlier book, actually, which is a collection of posts, wasn't it? He does actually stand out as saying, well, you know, he was pointing to issues, you know, in 2006, 2007 about the next recession, which is why I think it was called the next recession. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And you've kept the title. So sign up to look it up, go there. And every week, or sometimes more often than once a week, sometimes twice a week, posts come pouring out of Michael, full of data and graphs and whatever. That's why, as he quoted me yesterday, he's got a graph for every occasion. I haven't brought along any graphs. I'm disappointed that Al Campbell isn't here, because Al Campbell would have come along with some different graphs,
yeah,
and posed a different sort of challenge and a different sort of critique. And I think it's a shame he's not there, but he does. I think what we all share is, firstly, we take as Fred was just saying, we take the rate of profit analysis in Marx seriously. We don't dismiss it, we don't think it's incoherent, we don't think there's a, we don't believe in the Occhio theorem, we don't actually, you know, take the Sraffian position or whatever, you know, for people who know about these things. We take it seriously. We also, I think, agree that there was a significant fall in the rate of profit, especially obviously very clear in the US and UK economies and to Japan and so forth, very clear. I think there's more questions about figures elsewhere, but very clear for the core economies, if you like, from the mid-60s through to the early 80s. And that was what then generated the response from capital, and I do think it's important to stress the agency of capital and not be over-deterministic about this. And I've put some stuff up there which I'm going to come back to, that's my scribbles. And that led to, if you like, what you might call the neoliberal counter-offensive, depending on how you want to put it, which I don't think was simply, by the way, about attacking wages. I think it was much broader than that. And I think also, we also have to think in terms of the globalization, to use this crude term, but what I would see as the restructuring of the international division of labor, and increasing financialization, which I'll come back to as well. So we locate that, I think we all, certainly the three of us, and I think Al would as well actually, locate the falling profitability of the system through the 70s into the early 80s, despite inflation, despite Keynesian measures or whatever. We also, I think, agree on the limits to Keynesianism. I'll come back to that if I've got time, yeah, at the end. But then I think we agree on, as Anwar Sheikh was saying yesterday, that this was, you know, the stagflation of the 70s was something that the Keynesians could not adequately explain, and that we actually, if you want to get to grips with what was going on there, you have to talk about profitability. Okay, so that's where we agree. Where do we disagree? Okay, let me move, I'll come back to the stuff up there, but let me move from the abstract to the concrete and see how far I get in terms of the book. Because I want to start with a point, an argument really made, and here I'm going to agree with David Harvey in particular. And there's a collection of articles, which unfortunately comes out in a very expensive book, but if you ask Bob nicely, he might send you the electronic version, called The Great Financial Meltdown, based on, I think it was Conference in Istanbul or something like that, was it? But there's a variety of contributions, including the one by Simon Moen, where he talks about what Fred was talking about, which Fred summed that up, so I won't go there. But the point I think that David Harvey keeps making, and I think he's right to make, is that capital is, although it might be primarily in the first instance about the production of value and surplus value, you know, the volume one story, there's also a volume two story. And the volume two story is about, well, actually David Harvey talks about it in terms of realization. I would prefer actually to do it, as Marx put it, to talk about capital as the contradictory unity of production and circulation. Because I think circulation is the broader category within which enables us to get the grips of the question of realization in a more concrete form. But I think realization, to adequately deal with realization, you've got to take a few further steps. I think was something that Anwar Sheikh was sort of pointing to yesterday afternoon, but didn't quite spell out what the steps would be, as it were. And I don't think Marx took them all. And there's important, that, if you like, is the heart of my argument, because I worry about what I would call a certain reductionism in the way Michael approaches the question. And I'll use that word, whilst acknowledging the significance of the underlying tendencies and counter tendencies, I think we also have to, if we're gonna have an adequate account of what's going on in the system, we need to take into account more of the, what I would call, in a Hegelian term, if you like, the mediations, or the connecting links, if you wanna be a bit more basic about it. And I think I particularly thought this actually in response to Michael's presentation in London back in November, and I've gone away and looked at this, and actually I think there are significant consequences if you simply dismiss realization or question of demand when we're analysing the dynamics of the system. And I think Michael has a tendency to do that, which he then backtracks from sometimes. And if you neglect volume two of capital, I think you have a further series of consequences follow. You neglect the circulation, I'm going to just sum these up very quickly, because I want to move on. But I'm just, you neglect the circuit of capital, you fail to give sufficient attention to the impact of turnover time on profitability. And I think the turnover time is significantly diminished. And of course, that was another aspect, if you like, of the whole restructuring of capital that took place in the 80s and 90s and the speed, just-in-time production or whatever, which came up in another context. You fail to adequately address the significance of disproportionalities, which is my big thing, which I won't, however, go into it. Not just, however, by the way, simply in terms of departments one and two, or for those who don't know that, you know, the means of production and means of consumption in volume two, but actually I think it has wider implications. And I think you have a problem in dealing with the cycle. And Michael certainly stresses cycles. In fact, he has five or six cycles in the chapter on cycles in his book, which is really interesting. But I think that what's sometimes known as the Jugler. Is it Jugler? Anyway, whatever. Yeah. The Jugler is the name of this guy who first analysed this. What one might call, what Marx certainly saw as the business cycle, that the 7 to 10 years, slightly irregular patterns, that has characterised the whole history of capitalism, I think cannot be directly explained in terms of the underlying tendency of the rate of profit to fall.
Not directly.
Nor do I think it can be explained in terms, as some people argue, Kalinikos, Alex Kalinikos has argued this, and it's, I think, Kahedi, to be honest, I think sometimes claims this, that there's an the interaction tendency and counter tendency directly explains that standard business cycle. I do think it that tendency and counter tendency can explain longer waves in profitability, which Michael also has. Maybe longer waves over the periods that we've been talking about, from the the 60s through to the early 80s. And there's enormous unevenness, by the way, as well, in terms of which I also think needs to be taken into account. I'll come back to that globally. But that's my core, if you like, that's my core theoretical argument. Yeah. Therefore, we need, in other words, to see the tendency of the rate of profit as Marx analysed it in terms of a rising organic composition of capital as a long-term tendency, but also subject to counter-tendencies. And, of course, the interaction between these and the cycles is a complex question, and the statistic, and how you address that. And unfortunately, Anwar Sheikh sort of touches on this, but never really gets quite there, because it's right at the end of his book, by the way. So I think he touches on that issue, because he talks about turbulence and fluctuations around the trend, but without really focusing very much on the, what's governing the cycles. And although I know he's done work on this, which I think is interesting. Well, he ends up actually with a Goodwin theory. But anyway, for those who know this stuff, he ends up sort of bringing Goodwin theory, which very much depends on variations in wage rates, and I don't think that's adequate either. Anyway, there's a whole issue here, which I think I'm going to refer to this, because what we have, I think, in Michael's book, it's not spelled out in great depth, because I think it's someone said it takes it for granted, is just this central lines here. So we have a rise in the organic composition of capital, which I would see, by the way, in terms of the ratio of debt to living labour. Michael tends to see it just in terms of C in relation to V, and I think then there's a problem about variations of wage rates. But if we see this as a function of mechanisation, I do think there is a tendency for the organic composition of capital to rise, but subject to the devaluation of capital and so forth, which Fred was referring to. So we have a line that gives organic composition of capital rising, falling the average rate of profit, falling the rate of investment. And I think if we're to actually examine the way in which the cyclical fluctuations have been operating, we need to make that picture a lot more complicated, actually. And we need to bring in at each stage, sorry, I don't know if Michael can see this, I'll sum them up. We need at both stages here, in terms of these links, to pose questions about other factors and other influences on the process. So in the first stage, what the average rate of profit the rates of profit certainly received by individual capitals are going to be affected in all sorts of ways, and therefore I think you have to take this into account if you look at the actual rates of profit that Michael's looking at, by raw material prices, I just added this in actually, unproductive labour costs, because Fred mentioned it, so I just put it in, the little quantities of unproductive labour, the
rate of surplus value, obviously, which is acknowledged, of course, by Michael, the turnover of capital and demand. And demand here seen as a function in particular of the relationship between the balance between the two departments, in my view. Yeah? And that when we talk about, as Michael did yesterday, about the overaccumulation of capital, by the way, I think we need to be talking, see that in terms of overproduction of, in particular, of means of production relative to the demand for those means of production coming both from, yeah, from within Department 2. And I also think there's a problem about the link between the average rate of profit and the rate of investment. And I think Al Cameron would have talked a bit more about that now. And this is the gap, if you like, which Cedric Durand posed yesterday in his talk, which becomes more apparent, I think, in the period since 2000. Andrew Glynn talked about this, and so on, and raises a question mark, at the very least. Because there's a lot of evidence, by the way, for the recent period, by the recent period, I mean the last few years since the crisis, of a rise in the mass of profit, and to, I think that implies a rise in the average in rate of profit, certainly in the United States, as Michael acknowledged yesterday, I think, yeah? But there's a gap, because investment rates have remained relatively depressed. And how do you explain that gap? Now, I think you need to bring in the interest rate, but then the interest rate's been very low. So in this case, you know, interest rate clearly hasn't been sufficient. I think we need to bring in debt. Michael's got a lot to say about debt. And we also need to look at actually the whole question of debt, the whole analysis of debt deflation, debt deleveraging of debt. There's a whole story that Richard Koo, analyst for Nomura, I don't know whether Michael, and this is a question for Michael actually, whether you looked at Richard Koo's work. But his emphasis, yep. He's a bit obsessive about it. He's a bit sort of unicausal, monocausal, if you like, because he makes...
I like that.
Or whatever you want to say. But what he's arguing is that we're in a period of protracted debt deleveraging, especially, but not just by companies, but also by households. And that's, because that's going on, basically that's why investment rates happen. And he starts with the Japanese economy. Yes, five? I've got five? That's great. Okay. And expectations. And Amos Sheikh yesterday, and I think quite rightly, and I had this here anyway, by the way, but I think quite rightly, was emphasising that what matters for investment is expectations. And expectations of future profitability are, to my mind, also going to be a function of uncertainty and lack of confidence, if you like. The Keynesian story comes in there and cannot be simply dismissed. It needs to be located within a Marxist framework. But, and I think that's what Amos Sheikh was pointing to when he was putting a big stress in his comments on the Cedric Durand paper, actually more perhaps than I think he did in the evening, on that what matters for investment is, and what matters for capitalists is the expectation of what the profit rate is going to be. And we have been in a period where there's been enormous uncertainty as a result of this.
Is this a mathematical quantity, the expectation, or not?
Well, no.
I'm just checking.
How do you mathematise expectations?
No, obviously there is.
Yes, okay, that's a very good point.
That's
yes. It's a very good question. It's a good question.
Okay, because I wasn't at the talk last night. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good question. Because it isn't, is it? How do you mathematise expectations?
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
I mean, you can go out and do a survey of what companies, you know, company executives think, you know, you can measure confidence, and they do, you know. The soft, as Michael was suggesting yesterday, the soft data is subject to all sorts of, yeah?
Less spirit than the animal.
Yeah, and so on. Where's my thing? Okay, so anyway, that's my broad argument. Within that, however, two key points, to be more concrete given the time available. Well, three key points. One is, I'm not persuaded that this is where Michael would have to go back to his data and graphs. I'm not persuaded that the relatively small 3%, it's not actually, it's 3% point drop, as it were, it's drop in the rate of profit, as even shown by Michael's data, mm-hmm. if one accepts it, in the period from sort of 2006, 2007, 2008, is an adequate explanation of, and just for the American economy, of the scale of the financial crisis that follows on its own. That's a very specific point. I could go on about that. But I think it's important to recognise
the significance of financialization and the scale of financialization and the bloating of the financial sector, and Michael certainly acknowledges this, doesn't dispute it at all. I mean, it's there, it's part of the debt chapter and so on, you know? It's there. But I'm not sure, and I said this last night, I'm not sure either Amos Sheikh even quite did it, that to talk about what happens in the financial sector and the subprime crisis and everything that then followed as simply a trigger really gets to grips with what I would see as another massive disproportionality in the system. To try and be a bit more systematic about it, to see that in actual fact the growth of the financial sector, especially in the Anglo-Saxon economies, but also, of course, actually other core economies are tied into this because the banking networks are so integrated, is in danger of being underestimated or not given sufficient weight in the crisis analysis. So that, yes, sure, there's a lot of evidence to show rates of profit on average, let's accept those, yeah, were, you know, certainly nowhere near back to the heights of the 1960s, certainly relatively flat on one account or slightly rising on another account in the period, yeah, from 2000. Hmm. But if we're really to get to grips with something, I think we need to acknowledge what's going on with the 40% of profits that are going, total profits in the United States that are going to the financial sector in the broadest sense, to FIRE, as it's known, you know, finance, insurance, real estate. The scale of bank lending to real estate companies, Michael Hudson says 70% of bank loans are going into mortgages or commercial property or real estate of one sort or another in this period. Isn't there not, there's no corporate debt in that sense of rising out of the banking system. Yes, there's bond issues and so on. Corporate companies are actually deleveraging in the United States in the period after the dot-com crash, so as I can make out. So I think there's a big question there. I also think there's a similar questions, I don't really have enough time to do this, over the whole Eurozone crisis. I don't like your chapter on the Eurozone, Michael. I really don't like it.
It's one of my favourites.
I mean, not that it's wrong to say there's a failing Euro project, although it's surviving better. Oh, you're off. Okay, sure. You were nodding. She was nodding.
Yeah. You're misled.
And anyway, I think, sure, you're right. You have to take Greece.
Yeah.
And I'll finish on this. I'll try and finish on this. Yeah, you've got a graph that shows the rate of profit in Greece crashing down. I've got the page here somewhere. Mm-hmm. What page is it? 163. Yeah, it's crashing down from 1960 to around about 1982. Mm-hmm. And then it's relatively flat. And then it falls again, post-2008 actually falls again. So accepting that.
You're right.
Accepting that, without going there. This does not give you any real indication of what actually then happens in the course of the 2000s with the building up of capital inflows into the Greek banking system and into the government borrowings, whatever. I mean, elsewhere, because the patterns vary. But the scale of the internal imbalances within the Eurozone, the significance of those financial flows, the way in which French and German banks, for example, get themselves up to their necks in lending to Greek banks as they were to Spanish banks and so on, which then means that the Greek economy has to be bailed out in order to rescue the French and German banks, that whole story is not there to the degree, it's not that you dismiss it, or I know you're not going to disagree with that story, but it isn't given, in my view, sufficient weight, and that matters. And why does it matter? Also, it matters because, in the end, the austerity story in Greece, which is, as I'm sure everybody here knows, has been absolutely catastrophic, is then in turn a response to that, imposed, of course, by the Troika, forced on, imposed even on the Syriza government, and that's a disaster that's been. But it's had real impact. Austerity measures have real impact, and therefore a program to reverse austerity measures may not bring us back to the boom years of the 1960s, but it will benefit ordinary workers and ordinary people in Greece. And to dismiss a program, or to dismiss Keynesian programs that simply want to reverse austerity, as not, of course, you know, this is not going to put an end to capitalism, it's not going to end the contradictions, it's not, they're not going to do anything like that, but I think it matters, and I think it matters for the left to not simply say in that context it's just down to the rate of profit, and therefore Keynesianism measures won't work. I think it was, there was scope for a reversal of austerity measures, which would have required a challenge to the euro, and there's a whole series of other issues, but I think those issues matter for us politically, and still matter, actually, especially if you're in Greece or Spain or, you know, places like that. I'll finish on that. Thanks.
Thanks. To you.
Okay, well, there's a lot to answer, and there's a lot to
answer for your book
and explain. Yeah, answer for the book and for explain. For those who haven't read the book, I'm just going to do a couple of slides which will give you an idea of what's in the book, or at least as far as I'm concerned, what are the important things, and what's new in this book, because there's lots of books. What's in it that's worth reading? I argue that there's a difference between depressions and recessions. Capitalism has regular booms and slumps, regular recessions, as Pete called every 7 to 10 years, the Jugler cycle, the business cycle. Even mainstream economists sort of recognize this, although they never explain it. But I'm arguing in this book there are occasions when those are just not the usual boom and slump recessions. We actually get very deep recessions where there's no real recovery back to the previous levels of growth, employment and income and so on. The late 1880s, 1890s in the UK and US is one, and the Great Depression of the 1930s, and we're in one now. That's an argument of this book, which is doesn't appear in other books on the whole, although I'll show you that there are other people who agree. Then I was, the other part of it is to look at the nature of the cycles of profit, and arguing that the business cycles and these longer cycles of rising profitability and falling profitability can all be linked together, I would argue, in such a way as to show how Marx's law of profitability and the movement of profit and investment can provide you with an explanation of business cycles and these longer cycles. An ambitious and probably refutable proposition, but that's one of the other ones in the book. And the other one is Marx's law. That's short for saying Marx's law of the tendency of rate of profit to fall. As Fred said, completely ignored the question of profit or profitability under capitalism by mainstream economics. Marx developed in his various works, a law of profitability, which he thought was the most important law to understand in political economy. Last night, Anwar said that Marx only managed one volume and the rest was a mess, and Engels had to sort it out. And therefore, we may not really know what Marx meant. Well, I don't think he said that, but I would say, well, that's what we're here for, isn't it? That we're trying to work out in our minds what we can learn from Marx's analysis of capitalism 150 years ago, and how that will be relevant to what we're doing now, and develop on it beyond that. And especially empirically in my argument, so that we can show that Marx's law is the best and most compelling explanation of these booms and slumps and depressions and breakdowns that we get in the capitalist economy, which are evident to people but are not explained, certainly not by mainstream economics, and even, in my view, explained by Keynesian economics if you don't consider that mainstream, actually I do, which is another argument. I think that Marx's economics is distinctly different from any other form of economics. When we had the session yesterday, that was a point I think made by Martha and others at that meeting, that it's distinctly different. It looks at the capitalist economy in a different way from any other. So I want to show that law is empirically supported. This book's got a lot of data and graphs, as Peter says, because it's not so much about the theory. The theory has been dealt by lots of people. Fred has produced recently a book which really deals in depth with all the different interpretations of Marx's economic theory. This is much more empirical. It's much more to the topical, and therefore is applying a different approach. But at trying to justify Marx's law from the empirical evidence. And I'm saying that what happens under capitalism, the two factors that matter, if you like, certainly in modern 21st century capitalism is what's happening with profitability, but also what's happening in this new world of finance capital being so much more dominant. What is happening to debt? How does that fit into this process, and what does it mean in terms of profitability? Is it a reaction to low profitability, and will the debt actually make things worse? We can read in volume 3 Marx's view about credit, and I think that's relating this empirically now. So I'm bringing that as a key factor. And then this book makes forecasts and predictions. That's a big sin. As we know, economists can't get anything right. Weather forecasters now can get things right over 3 days pretty accurately, and as we extend it beyond, on my mobile I can see how wrong they're getting, but certainly the first 3 days they're pretty good these days. Science has progressed. I'm arguing that scientific method isn't just a question of explanation and empirical justification of a theory or a hypothesis. It also must lead to prediction and forecast, just as any science would. If we're saying that this is how it works, then you should be able to start making an estimate of when that something is going to happen again, or whether it will happen again. This, of course, is regarded as something you should not do in economics. However, this book does. And therefore will fall on its predictions and forecasts that Fred mentioned in his contribution. And there are the predictions and forecasts at the end of this book, which will soon be proven wrong. And also, not just looking at the short term, but also the longer term. There are, at the end, I look at the question of capitalism and its three main challenges, as I see it, facing it, which is inequality is one, the low productivity inequality, the rise of more mechanization in the form of robots and AI, and the question of climate change. The rapacious drive for profit by capitalism globally now is destroying the planet. All these are issues which, on the longer term, and maybe not so longer term, are mentioned at least and taken up in the book towards the end. Now, just quickly, I want to say that, as I said, depression is a theme of this book, but it's not perhaps original. Even the man I hate had pointed out that we have a form of depression that took place in the 1930s. He came to the conclusion it wasn't a normal slump. It was had a particularly depth and length to it, which makes it different.
What is the source of the quotation?
Oh, gosh. I'll find it for you later.
It's not one of the major works. I think it's one of his shorter.
I think so. I'll find it for you. I don't think it's in GT, no.
No.
More recently, Anwar, probably about 5 years ago, wrote a piece on depression, and he makes the similar point that he considers the 2008 was unleashed a Great Depression. Even Paul Krugman actually said that he thought the late Great Recession was now a depression, and as I was explaining yesterday, wrote a book very quickly saying end this depression now, making the point that it was somewhat different. So it's not particularly neat, but the point I'm making here is this is how I look at it. On the top line you can see this as it were a modelling of what the differences are. Recession in 74-5, that's a normal boom and slump recession. A V-shape back to trend growth. We had a slightly different one in 1982, two double dips, the W, as it's called, and then back to trend growth. So I'm saying depressions are more like a square root on the right-hand corner there, that it comes down but it doesn't return to trend growth, and we can measure that fact. In the 19th century, that is an accurate measure of the difference to trend growth in those periods I worked out. And of course, don't ask me to defend it now, but basically it's more or less what it was like in terms of the drop in a sort of crudish manner, but it does fit into the period. And then in the trend growth in the 1930s, you can see we had that recovery from 32 to 37, which is very important to analyse in future. And then we had the drop back before the war took things back to trend growth while we blew each other up. And finally, this current depression, which I haven't extended beyond 2012, but if I were to do so, then it will be something like this, just coming up a little bit now. After 2017, here we are about 8 years later, a bit similar, I think, to the 32-37, but not actually as good in its recovery. And then you'd have to ask yourself whether it is going to get back to trend growth without something else happening. So I won't go through those, All those, of course I thought I did those yesterday, all those, all that. I'm not going to give you my 1 minute, how the law works in 1 minute. I like that, but you can't have it. I'm coming to this because Fred has raised a number of points about measurement of the rate of profit. This actually is the global rate of profit, and measured by Esteban Maito in Argentina. He's taken 13, 14 countries, and he's taken the national statistics of each country, and he's attempted to work out the rate of profit using matrix categories. And what he did was he took them all and then he weighted mean them together to get a global rate of profit. Now, already you can see that that is going to be short of what we mean in Marxist theory, because if we believe that Marxist economics is based on a whole economy, capitalist economy, then it's the whole total surplus value against the whole capital invested or on the denominator for the world, which we obviously cannot measure in any way practically at the moment. So the second best, you might consider it worst best alternative, is to take national rates of profit and weight them up and see what you get. And this is what you get from Maito back to 1855. Just so that he doesn't attack me, I have, how can I put this, doctored it to make it a little better for us to follow. More arguments to follow from that. But basically the gist is that you can see that not only is there a tendency of the rate of profit to fall, but it actually does fall. And if you read volume 3 and all the other points that Marx makes on the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, for me it is clear that the tendency will operate. There are counteracting tendencies which will slow, curb it for periods of time, even reverse it, but not indefinitely. And if you're taking a period since Marx wrote Capital to now, if we didn't get a picture of something like that globally, then we really shouldn't be discussing this at all, because it's irrelevant, in my view. Unless we can empirically support this theory, then it doesn't begin to have any explanatory power of what's going on. And the evidence would show, and we can see that it's not a straight line, there's all kinds of periods when, particularly in the war period, and there, and I think if you look further back, you can probably get it for the First World War and so on, there are periods of uptick. Now, you think the period of the neoliberal period, which we all talk about, I'll come back to that in a minute, you can see that basically from 1982 there's been a bit of flat lining. This is the global one, not the US one. I'll come to that for a moment. And you can see that that flattens out. So what we're talking about here, we can begin to perhaps see certain waves in profitability. Oh, going the wrong way. And that's what I do in the book. I actually look at when periods when the profitability, this is for the US alone, goes up. Okay, better figures than this. And then we have periods when the profitability is generally on the downswing. And you can fit that in to a series of cycles, the longer cycles that Kondratiev identified in the 1920s. And if this is correct, and by the way, if you read the last chapter of Shaikh's book, somehow it seems very similar to this. I tell you, I didn't know his position before that, and he certainly didn't know mine. And so you can see that we're in a period when we're in a winter, as it's called, depressionary period for profitability, for growth, where you're going to get very poor growth, you're going to get slumps, a depression. But that lasts over a certain period of about, say, 20 years or so in a phase, and then it turns around. That's the theory. This is the prediction. So you can see there's a prediction here. If nothing happens to turn this around by 2018, then you can remain to that book for the dollar that you'll find it down the road. But it's trying to present you with an argument here. Now, if I can just take up some of the points that Fred's made. 5 minutes, so you've hardly even started answering the questions. That's the book, in a way. But let me just answer a few things quickly then on the measurement. Fred is absolutely right. If you're including government wages in the denominator, at least, for the variable capital, and really also for, if you're looking at the net product as well, probably, well, we can discuss that in a second, but certainly on the denominator, then you're not getting a clear, accurate picture of the rate of profit. Now, in my measurements, and I've actually got a Word document and the Excel document available if anybody wants it, which explains line by line exactly where I get the data from, which line from NEPA, how I've measured it, and then the actual workings in Excel for people to play with. I sent it to a young Swedish graduate student who ripped it apart, sorted it out, and now I feel very confident that even Fred would find it acceptable. But in the case of the US and in the UK, which I've done the work on, which is unpublished, we don't include government wages in variable capital. However, with the global figures, that's not so simple, because you cannot get the breakdowns on national statistics. So in those figures, they don't, as it were, compatible with the US figures. All I can say is that the trends over a longer period are more or less the same. The other way of doing it, of course, is to look at corporate sector only, which most other measurements, Marxist measurements, have done. Deepak Basu has gone through every single way you can measure it, from whole economy, as I call it, to corporate, to non-financial sector, and so on, whether you use the denominator in historic costs, whether you use it in current costs, and so on. And it's a very useful weather short paper which covers all the possible ways of measuring it. And if you just use the corporate sector or the non-financial corporate sector, then the question of government wages obviously more or less falls out of the equation, I suppose. But it generally does. So you can, on that basis, and if you want to use that, then you find basically the same trend, at least faster the US, as you would find if you used a more a whole economy one. If you want to, in my short Word document and others, and the Excel drive, I also replicate everything that Andrew Kleiman's done on his rate of profit. He has a specific position, as you know, that you can only measure the denominator of the rate of profit in historic cost terms for fixed capital. Other people disagree. I've put his workings, I've replicated every single bit of his working against other ways of doing it, and then you can see the difference. And there is a difference for a period of time, but on the whole, by now, actually, because the difference turns out to be something to do with the inflation point that you were making, that it begins to disappear, as Deepak Basu points out, that over a long period of time, the difference between historic and current cost measures begin to disappear. They narrow up, and you get a more or less, over a fairly long period of time. So you can easily be fooled in a neoliberal period to think everything's booming, while Andrew says it isn't booming in profitability terms. But on the whole, there is a similarity on the trends. Foreign profits, yes, things have changed. We do have rest of world profits in the corporate thing, but that doesn't include what the corporates are hiding abroad, or have held their money abroad and made their profitability there. Some people have made an estimate about whether that would make a big difference to profitability on the grounds that the profits of foreign investment or returns on foreign investment are probably not much greater than they would be in domestic circumstances, but it's another area for discussion.
So it's only repatriated profits.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can't be sure that you've captured everything on the top line at any rate.
Sure you have.
Yeah, certainly haven't. Well, we know there's $7 trillion in tax havens, and a lot of that might be, obviously that's a stock, but it's difficult to judge whether that makes a huge difference to profitability. What I would say is that one of the projects I'm engaged in, if I'm still around in a year's time, I'm getting old, is to look at the productive sector rate of profit alone, working that with Mino Kalkedi, just looking at the productive sector. Now, Mino did actually do the productive sector alone as he defined it for the US. I mean, it's a question of what is productive and unproductive labor. No time for that, but the gist of it is, if we just take the productive sectors, if we can define them, at least it gives us a clearer idea. Of course, within the productive sectors there are unproductive workers, but, you know, we can go on indefinitely doing that, but we can at least get a little bit closer. That's a project that I have in mind for this year, because I think Fred's absolutely right. Unless we do that, we cannot take into account the factor of unproductive labor and the increasing amount of the surplus, if you like, ends up with unproductive workers. And Fred's, I don't know, you should read what Fred wrote in that paper before, because in my first book, The Great Recession, I specifically mentioned that work as being one of the factors which over a period of time will affect the rate of profit, but probably not cyclically, or even over, because it is a structural thing, I think. And then therefore, in a cyclical say, and I'm talking cycle of maybe of 25 years, not the 7 or 10, it won't be decisive in changing the trends of the rate of profit. But over a much longer period of time, and the unproductive sector has undoubtedly expanded dramatically, and it must be a powerful curbing factor on the rate of investment and on profitability as well.
Which is a continued downward weight.
Yep, absolutely. It is. So if we can look at the productive sector on the one hand to see what's happening with profitability, and we can also take into account the effect of the unproductive sector, as Fred has suggested, we will have much clearer picture. I can't deal with Simon Mohun's position about he finds that originally he found that we should add back 18% of the wages in the US economy because of supervisory workers being 18% of the economy. I disagree with that. I said, you know, just because I tell you to go and get that tool down the road, that doesn't make me a member of the surplus value breed. But Fleiman's done some excellent work, and he shows exactly the number of people, employees, who get wages who actually don't need the wages there. They can live off the income of capital. It's about 2%. In fact, he said to me the other week, or the other month, it's the 1%. Surprise. And the rest of us, 99% working, if we are actually in the variable capital.
1% of the people, but much greater than 1% of the money.
Of the money, yes. Yeah, something like 17-18% in the US at the moment. So that does make a bit of a difference to the figures, but probably not a little bit to the trend, because obviously it's been rising. But I still don't think it's probably decisive in changing the results. Now, quickly on Pete's position, well, again, it's impossible to deal with all the arguments. And that's really sad about things like this, isn't it? Because we really should take 3 hours discussing all these different points so that you all drop dead before we get to the end. But to answer deep points that Peter's made about the whole nature of Marx's theory of crisis in the next 30 seconds is not going to be possible. And all I can say is that Pete wants to make the point that I am, well, the usual phrase is fundamentalist or monocausal or reductionist. Namely that all I'm interested in is in profitability, and if the profitability goes down and then the mass of profits go down, we get a crisis. But surely that's not an adequate explanation of a crisis. Because what about realization? What about, because if we look at Marx's work, Capital Volume 2 is about the realization of surplus value, not just the production of it. And there, to use David Harvey's position, which is his latest one, you should go on YouTube and watch it. He has a little diagram where everything goes round. You start off with production, then you go into realization volume 2, then you go to distribution volume 3, and then it comes back. So you've got a circuit of capital, and there are leaks. It doesn't have to be just where production is. It can be a leak in circulation, it can be a leak in distribution, and that's where, so you can get all kinds of leaks. It reminds me of an argument I was mentioning yesterday of the mainstream economists saying that they're plumbers and they've got to go around and fix the leaks. He's saying that there are leaks everywhere, and it's not just in production of surplus value, it's also in the circulation of surplus value and in the distribution of surplus value. Well, I haven't got time to answer that, but I don't think that's the way to characterise Marx's work, because he's saying that it's the production of surplus value, and the most important law is how that comes into contradiction with the growth of production. The surplus value does not rise sufficiently to sustain the investment in production, and you get a tendency for the rate of profit to fall. In other words, surplus value doesn't rise as fast as the capital stock building up over a period of time, and that is key to reducing the crisis. I like to answer the question on demand. It's yes, when we're in a slump, there's no demand. People don't have any money to buy things, and small capitalists particularly don't have any profits to invest. It's a lack of demand. But is that an explanation of the crisis? It's a description of the slump, but is it an explanation? Now you say, oh, well, that's monocausal. You don't recognize that it's demand as well. And then we come to volume two, where we have consumption sector and we have capital goods sector. What you could have is a crisis when the capital goods sector outruns the consumption sector. Well, all I have to say is that the capital goods sector always outruns the consumption sector. The evidence is there. Kleiman has actually shown it very well in his book. there's plenty of other evidence to show that the capital goods sector generally grows faster, not larger, it grows faster than the consumer sector, but it doesn't produce crises all the time. So there must be more of a kernel reason why this process eventually leads to a series of crises. And I try to link profitability, that's the rate of profit coming down, with eventually a fall in the mass of profit. So when we're talking about overproduction, we're not. We're talking about the absolute overaccumulation of capital at a certain point where investment no longer even produces more profit. Those kernel points are, in my view, big points of crisis and slump, which turn it into the slump that we've talked about now. These can be counteracted by all the factors that Marx describes, and particularly in the recent period by the use of debt, to expand the debt to, as we know, credit can keep things going. I don't know, lots of different ways you can analyze that, but it's like a yo-yo, isn't it? You can throw it out there and you can keep on going, the yo is going out there, and the whole thing keeps on going forward, and then snap, it comes right back, and suddenly we've got no credit. But what's important is what was holding on at the other end. You know, you can't let go. There was a book, I think, by yet another Keynesian, who said that all we have to do is keep on printing money. There is no end to what we can do if we keep on printing money, because there's nothing to stop us printing money indefinitely. Money out of the air forever. Just keep giving the banks and everybody more money, and frankly, just put it in everybody's households' accounts. That's, you know, people's QE. That will solve the crisis, because what's wrong is the problem of money. Well, I finish on this point, Chair, that what's wrong with Keynesianism is that Keynes thinks we have a monetary economy and the lack of money comes along occasionally, so we just have to give it more money. Marx said, no, it's not a money economy, it's a money-making economy, and what decides the issue for capitalism is what happens to profit, and if profitability starts collapsing, then you will get the crisis. Is it? And you can give everybody a piece of paper or raise their account and you think that's going to take things forward. Well, we haven't got time to discuss what would happen if you did that, but I think you should need to look at it from that point of view. And this book tries to defend a view of crises and the future. I haven't got dealt with that, except the prediction for in the next 2 years or so. We will have another slump, because I do not see any possibility of getting out of this recession without devaluing the capital that we've been talking about, which hasn't clearly taken place sufficiently to create new levels of profitability and growth. So the most likely is that we will have another recession. A frightening thought after what's happened after the last 8 or 9 years for the population of at least the major economies, let alone the rest. I don't think we're going to have a world war, which is what happened in the Great Depression to end the Depression. I have to say this, Chair. Wow. In Scheich's last chapter, he talks about this question, and he says that it was Keynesianism that solved the problems in the 1930s. And if only Roosevelt hadn't tried to balance the budget in 1937, they would have got out of the crisis. I disagree entirely. And I've looked at the data, and you can find it on my blog, the data on the Great Depression, and you can see that actually it made the 1937 go fallback was precisely because profitability was still unable to recover. And what did change things was the war. And why? Because government investment completely took over, and the whole of civilian production was militarized through government control. Wages were paid high, but nobody was allowed to spend anything on anything useful. They were rationed. There was a massive increase in surplus value. So at the end of the Second World War, profitability was at huge heights in the US, let alone elsewhere, through physical destruction of capital. So in that case, war made the difference. It didn't make the difference in the 19th century. I don't think it will this time, hopefully. So those are the arguments I'm presenting here for how things would change, and why we must look to Marx's law of profitability as our guiding instrument for understanding what's going on in the world economy.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.